Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to the Ruler podcast, and if you're listening to this anytime close to when we made it, happy Christmas. In this edition, I catch up with the extraordinary Pippa York, writer, broadcaster, and one of Britain's most successful cyclists, formerly known as Robert Miller. We'll also be hearing from a couple of pros on what Christmas Day has in store for them. We start, though, with news about one of the UK's most talented riders, news which caused a degree of surprise and shock when it first emerged. Nothing to do with Chris Froome. This is the news that Helen Wyman, multiple British cyclocross champion, former European champion, is without a main sponsor for next year. Ironic, given that this season is already shaping up as one of her best. Ruler's Ian Cleverley caught up with her at a race in an unlikely cross venue near Girona.
So last year I broke my collarbone and I plummeted down the world ranking to 30th in the world. And it's really, your world ranking relates to your start position on the grid, and it's really important to be at worst in the top 16 in the world. So because I lost all of my points, it's a rolling ranking system, I lost all of my points, I've come to smaller races, to C2 races, to get as many as I can. I live in the south of France in the summer, and so for me, it's only actually 2.5 hours from my house, and I can come down, have a training camp, and then finish off with a race before I go back to Belgium.
Racing when it's absolutely rock hard and bone dry, I guess you don't get to do too often, certainly not in Belgium.
No, the courses are very different here. The last course I did actually was a C1 race in Alloria, and that was in the Basque Country, and it was super muddy. It was amazing. It was a fantastic race. Here, it's dry. I mean, it was frozen this morning because we're in the mountains, but now it's, 13 degrees, and it's warm and dry and dust and things like that. And there's so many corners in the races. It's crazy. But they are trying to make the most of what they have, and so they've used the banks and things like that. And you can get gaps, it's just super fast racing.
This is all new to me, Catalan Cross, but in Spain it's Catalunya and the Basque Country, and I'm guessing the rest of the country doesn't even bother, do they?
Pretty much. I mean, most of the races, like Agori, which was a World Cup once, and those races are all over in Basque Country, and then, you've got the scene over here. And I mean, it is a really good scene, and there's not so many people here today because it's midweek, but technically it's a holiday because it's St. Nicholas Day. The races at the weekend, you'll get really good crowds, and it's a nice scene, and the people are friendly, and they get excited when foreign riders come down and do really well.
In the last few weeks, you've had how many wins now, and you've had World Cup podiums? I mean, you're back on top of your game, huh?
Yeah, this is my 6th win of the season, and I had 2 World Cup podiums in Bigenza, Bonza, and Zeven. So yeah, it's got muddy, and so as soon as it gets muddy, I start to get really good results, and it's what I'm naturally better at. So it's easier for me to do that. And I tried my absolute hardest to win that bike race. I really felt I could win it, and it's been a long time since I've felt I've been in that position in a World Cup, which is really, I'm really excited for, and I know I've trained harder again since then, and so I'm really excited for Christmas block, really.
And you also now have 4 Koppenberg cobbles. Now I believe Steph had to make some shelves to accommodate the first 3, and now you've gone and ruined it and he has to start again.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, we have in our house in France, it's a really old house, but the inside is brand new, and in the building work he actually cut into the walls, and he created these glass shelves so that I can display the 3 cobbles and my world's medal, my European champs win medal, and a national champs win medal, so that it's a really cool display, basically. Then I went and won a 4th one, and now it just just doesn't work.
just ruined it.
Ruined it.
Poor Steph. I mean, you know, the things he has to do for you is just ridiculous. Now, after 8 seasons with Kona, am I right in thinking?
Yeah.
You know, you are out of contract. How does that work?
I've had a really good run with Kona. They're really good guys. They've supported me for a really long time. And it's hard in racing to be able to stay with a company for such a long time. And so they've been fantastic. But unfortunately, they've restructured, or I don't know really what, but they haven't renewed my contract. So December 31st is my last day as a Kona rider. And from the 1st of January, yeah, I'm on my own.
And how do you... irons have you got in the fire to make something happen for next season?
There's a few things currently which we're working on. Every other sponsor that I've had has stayed with me. They're really happy with what I've done. I don't think Kona were disappointed in what I've done. It was purely a restructure thing. But all my other sponsors have stayed with me, and some of them have upped their input, which is really good of them. And we're working on some other things. And I will definitely continue until the end of the season. And then after that, we need to put more things in place.
Gridding world champs-wise, currently, points-wise, you'd be on the second row of the grid. So over the next couple of races, the idea is your aim is to put yourself in the front row and put yourself in with a good chance of a medal.
Yeah, I had 4 goals for this season, and one of them was to win Koppenberg. That's always a goal for me, and this year particularly was really important with a new course. And one of them was to be the second row, guaranteed second row by Worlds. And I've just gone up to 10th in the world ranking. And so now I've had to reassess. And I've still got extra World Cup points to gain, which other people don't have because it's the rolling ranking and they already have the points. So I think I could be front row for Worlds, which would be absolutely fantastic. It'd be a dream because you just want to stay out of trouble, and you want to have the option to be on the front row to get out of trouble and not have to rely on other people being faster around you. So that's a goal, and then I have 2 other goals.
Which will remain under your jersey?
Oh, one of them is Nationals, because that's like... I was so disappointed I couldn't race Nationals last year, and that would be the first time in about 15 years that I haven't raced. And I really want to win Nationals again, because 9's a nice number, but 10's like a really round number, isn't it? It's like satisfying. And Nikki obviously wants to win as well, and she's super strong this year too, but I really want to get that jersey back.
Helen Wyman. Pippa York was one of the stars of this year's Ruler Classic event, with her well-informed and sometimes sceptical take on the world of pro cycling. As Robert Miller, she was for many years the most successful British Grand Tour rider, with podium finishes and mountain jerseys on her palmares. In those days, of course, cycling in the UK was very much a fringe sport, and her achievements went largely unrecognised by the wider public. So is she surprised by cycling's newfound attention and the mainstream success of events like the Ruler Classic?
I've been to similar things in Paris and Brussels, but in France and Belgium, cycling's a mainstream sport, so for finally Britain to catch up to that level of interest has been quite amazing.
Do you wish the sport had been like this when you were racing in the UK, that you had this sort of level of attention?
I'm not sure there's an answer to that, because if I say no, it sounds like I was more interested in being in Europe, and if I say yes, it sounds like I was sorry to be in Europe, so there's no real answer to that question.
It's more about the sort of level of attention.
The level of interest. Probably it would have made my interaction with British journalists a little bit easier, because they would have come equipped with knowledge that being a professional cyclist in the 80s and the start of the 90s wasn't a kind of seasonal job. So it would have made that interaction slightly easier. I'm not sure it would have changed how I viewed my whole career, because basically I had to be based in Europe, so... 50-50 answer to that question.
This past year, the past few months have been, I imagine, pretty extraordinary for you. Just the level of attention.
They've been interesting. In the when I competed, I didn't realise that the effect of my career at that elite top level affected so many people. I just got on with it and assumed that what I was doing, okay, it was a pioneer in some parts of it, but you know, the rest of it was kind of following on with the previous kind of top level people who went before me. So I just assumed I went there to do hopefully better than they had done in the past, and I just got on with that, and I didn't realise that it was kind of followed so closely back in the UK.
And when you announced your transition earlier this year, when you became public about it, from everything that I saw, the response from, especially from cycling fans, was 100% positive, or seemed very positive. Were you expecting that?
I didn't expect it to be so overwhelmingly positive. I expected that there would be less friction in these times than it would have been 10 years ago. So I saw the change from my daughter going to school, and the education they received and the way they dealt with diversity was very different to my generation and the generation that just came after that. So probably a big kind of cultural change from the millennium onwards, in that the whole diversity and equality and gay rights issues, if you want to take it to that level, then that became much more apparent, that it wasn't anything that was kind of to be feared. So having to wait so long to make my kind of announcement, it kind of reassured me that although there's still doubts that it can go badly, the feeling I got from speaking to my daughter and to kind of people who were involved in cycling, that it would go okay, and it, I think it went really well.
You always gave the impression during your career that you were someone who wasn't particularly comfortable with the limelight, weren't particularly comfortable being a celebrity, even on the continent.
I wouldn't call being a professional sports person a celebrity. First and foremost, you're there to produce performance, and I emphasise that more than I did the media part of it. So I think that for somebody, a kind of UK athlete, being at world level was a kind of rarity, and it didn't matter if that was cycling or any other kind of sport. So the previous people came back from that, and they didn't necessarily be in a comfortable position financially to just choose what they wanted to do, so they would kind of have to throw themselves into the kind of media scrum to secure a living. So I think that was the general perception that the public had, that when you were a professional person in sport, then you also had this totally accessible part of your life, and that wasn't what I saw around about me in Europe. That we 100% focused what we did, and the media part was something that we did afterwards. It wasn't actively sought out.
But were you uncomfortable with fame? Because you were famous, whether you were a celebrity or not. You were famous. You were well known, especially on the continent. Were you uncomfortable with that? Or?
No, but how I dealt with it wasn't the normal way of dealing with it. So I took my cultural clues for that kind of level of fame, as you call it, I called it achievement.
I suppose the fame is a result of the achievement.
Yeah, so I took that interest in how I went about my life from people like McEnroe, Navratilova, so slightly aggressive, you know, not the norm that went before, not the polite kind of British English way of always saying sorry. So they would say, you know, the kind of the classic McEnroe thing, you've got to be kidding. So I kind of took they were my role models in how to deal with sport and the interest in it, and yeah, that's what I did, and that allowed me to have this little barrier which kept some me time.
That barrier was part of that, your sort of knowledge that you were actually living not how you wanted to be living, not how you were.
No, not really. The whole kind of gender stuff that I would have going on in the background at times was a totally different set of issues to deal with. The media persona that I had of being slightly difficult and awkward and not readily accessible allowed me to perform to my 100%. So if I'd given a little bit more time to do media stuff, that would have meant less time for recovery, less time to figure out what was going wrong. So that was the calculation I made, that I wasn't employed to appear on news at 10 every day. I was employed to be in the front in bike races, and I prioritised that.
During the sort of period where you were out of the public eye after you retired from pro cycling, did you still follow the sport, or did you cut yourself off from it? Did you still follow it as a fan or an informed observer?
At first I did follow it, and then once my transition became serious and I reached the end of the kind of the parts where you have professional help, once I reached the end of that, you get a time when you kind of you've reached the end of what they're helping you with, and you're out there into the world on your, not on your own, but you're the counselling and the help that you get from the medical profession, that comes to an end at a certain point, and you have to become your own person. And when I became that new person, I had less and less interest in cycling, so I kind of let it go. I wasn't interested in who won Tour de France stages or the kind of classics and that stuff. I had to let it go because I needed that space inside my head to build up the kind of persona that I was going to become.
When did you start taking an interest? I presume that you now do have an interest in follow cycling.
Or so, yes.
When did you start doing that again?
I think that was, well, I wouldn't say blame. That was thanks to David Miller. When he stopped his career, he invited me to his book launch. I felt that there was a small space in that kind of world where I could kind of exist on the sidelines. And I became good friends with David's mother, Avril. So Avril became a kind of big sister to me, and took over that kind of role of like a big sister does, advising you not to mess up here and there. So that kind of got me back into the whole kind of doing a little bit of journalism here and there and writing stories and telling tales.
Well, you describe it as telling tales and telling stories. One of the things I think a lot of people will say is you're a very good writer. You're an extremely good journalist. Sometimes the things that you write in Rouleur magazine are amongst the best things in the magazine. Have you always been a writer?
No, I was dreadful at English at school. Unsurprisingly, being in Scotland and being in Glasgow, the English wasn't exactly a subject which pushed forward, you know, so English history and all that stuff basically touched upon it. And English language, I had no real interest in it. But then when I was a writer, a few of the magazines asked me to write a kind of column every month. And my skills improved by doing that. So my spelling and the kind of structure of how to put it together and where to put pauses and paragraphs and kind of tell you the whole tale that you're going to tell, that developed into the kind of where it is now. But it's everything I write, I criticize it, I send it, and then I realize that I could have written that better. So there's always that kind of obsessive compulsive part of my character which thinks I could have done that slightly better.
I remember reading an article that you wrote years and years ago in one of the cycling magazines about all the sort of old wives' tales almost that have been passed down to you as a professional cyclist about what to eat and when to sleep and all that sort of thing. I remember thinking that was one of the best articles about cycling I'd read at the time, and was sort of disappointed you didn't do much more at that stage.
Well, didn't that turn into the whole kind of rules things, like the Illuminati rules? We used to, because we didn't come from the French, Belgian, kind of Dutch culture of it was ingrained into you from the age of 12 or whenever you started racing. So we looked at that and thought, I'm going to climb into a team car, it's 30 degrees, there's no air conditioning in there, I feel like I'm at 40 degrees and I have to wear a woolly hat, are you nuts? And then you had to always cover your legs up and stuff like that, and it didn't make common sense to us. So we laughed, we kind of thought, this is just crazy. And it kind of turned into this whole, we looked at it totally different from the Europeans did. We kind of thought, that's not right, these guys are crazy, but we went along with it because that's what you did.
I remember there was something about taking the middle out of baguettes, but I can't remember which bit
you
were supposed to eat.
You take the middle, because because the bread's going to slow you down somehow, you take the kind of doughy bit out the middle of your baguette so it doesn't drop into your stomach and spend ages there. But then the really silly thing about that is then they would advise you to eat a steak, which takes 7 hours to process. So you had to throw away the bit of bread, the bit of doughy bread in the middle, because that would slow you down. But then you had a steak, which you'd still be processing in your bed the next day.
Have you enjoyed the bits of TV commentary you've done?
I did. I thought I'd done a little bit before, and I wasn't in a place, personally, I wasn't in a place where I wanted to, I felt like I had anything to add to it. Probably still too close to my career. But nowadays I can look at it with a more reflective role in what I have to say. So it's not the same way as with Ned and Dave on ITV4, where they're kind of filling up the general time and David's telling you tactics which are going to happen or may happen. The role that they had with the guests was to add some insight into certain parts of it and then bring in little stories of what happened to you on those days. So that was quite interesting, and it was different to what I'd been expecting. I'd been expecting before when I'd done it before.
Are you going to be doing more? Do you know yet?
I don't know. I would love to do more. I don't know. That's up to them.
The other thing, with your writing, are you at a stage where you would want to write an autobiography?
You know, if I had a pound for every person that asked me when I was going to write a book, I'd probably have a chateau somewhere. You know, people have been asking me for probably the last 10 years to do it, and I say to them, I have the idea, I have the title, I have the cover, and I have the general feel for the stories, but it isn't your normal sport in my life stories. So there's no speaking about gaining 20 seconds here or using this gear ratio or we had new aero helmets or overshoes. There's none of that. It's just stories which happened kind of round about the bike race or after the bike race or on the way to the bike race. Those kind of stories, because I find them more entertaining than the kind of basic facts of I did this, I did that. I don't see life as basic kind of facts. I look at it and I want to be entertained by what I write, and I want people to be entertained by that kind of story.
But surely the response that you've had in the past few months shows that there's a real interest in that. If you did write that book, there would be enough
there
people to buy
is,
it.
There probably is, but then I'm aware that now the things I do, so the things I'm doing now are in the kind of Christmas period where everybody puts out their DVD and their CD and their book, and I'm aware that I don't live in that world, so I'm not here to sell anything. And the kind of idea of the whole autobiography, it's not an autobiography in the sense that I'm going to tell you anything about my kind of inner person. It's more stories of which happened to me in various places at various times, and I don't want it written in any kind of chronological order. So the first story, which I started writing the first kind of story that I wanted to write, and it was a totally random story, which vaguely had something to do with a bike race. I won't say any more about it, because if I do write the book, or the stories that will be made into a book, then it kind of makes sense. But it is all totally, slightly strange stories.
Well, I look forward to it if you ever do it.
Yeah.
You've said a few times that you don't want necessarily, you don't see yourself as a sort of as a campaigner. That's not how you see yourself. But have there been people who've got in touch with you? Have there been young people who've talked to you about their own situations? And has that changed your mind in any way about your role? Or
individually, no, people haven't come to see me. It's interesting you ask that, because I've just been to Stonewall, and I'm what they call an influencer in their terms. So I'm introducing them to certain people where they want to have improve various things which have happened. So quite soon they're going to go and see British Cycling and see how they can improve their kind of human resources policies, I think is how they term it. So that you know they have a plan for their performance, but the plan that they've had for looking after the people that come into contact with the organisation could be better than the standard kind of bog standard government speak stuff that they have. So British Cycling has been known for being the standard for performance, and so now they've realised with the issues that have come out that they have the chance to get their kind of human contact and resources and that whole kind of inclusion and equality thing, they can be the standard for that for the other sporting bodies which have also had problems.
That's something that you might be happy to help with or be
yeah
part
I
of.
Think it's important with the profile I have to use that to make things better. So in your sporting career you set down standards and the people that come afterwards try to beat them, and that's why that's part of why you do it. You try to be the best from your kind of area and then the best from your country, and if you're talented enough you become the best in the world. So and the guys that come next they try to better that, so that's understandable. But there's also that kind of influence that you should have using your profile to make things better for your children or other people's children so that they come into a better world. It all sounds kind of slightly Sethy, but it kind of makes sense when you see the interaction of how young people are educated today, and it's a different feelings, and they have what they know as safe spaces, which my generation wouldn't have had. Everybody would just laugh at you with that stuff, but I've taught my children that not to put up with the crap that I put up. So you have to kind of take responsibility of that and then stand to say to people of my generation, you know, that that's not good enough. I don't want my children or their friends to go into your organisation and put up with the crap that you think I'm going to put up with. So the kind of the way that coaching is going to have to evolve to meet young people's expectations that's going to have to modify itself and then change. And that'll take a certain amount of time because it's been a culture, it's been there for a long time.
I've thought a few times that given your experiences with British Cycling, the British Cycling Federation, as it probably was then, in the past, you must have looked at some of their problems over the past year or so with a slightly wry sort of look.
It's not up to me to kind of launch any kind of investigation and what they did. You know, the brief that they were given was to produce medals, and that's what they did. And I think somewhere along the line, as it got bigger and bigger and more people came in, they lost sight that they were dealing with human beings instead of just medal production people. So I think they've now realised that with the stuff that's come out quite recently. And other sports also, it's not just a cycling, it's that culture of aggressive coaching and what I would call the kind of shouting at people for results. That doesn't, in the workplace, that doesn't happen. That doesn't make for a happy working environment. So the young people of today don't need to put up with that stuff. It's not what I want to see. And I don't think, and I know from speaking to my daughter's friends, it's not what they expect to happen to them when they go into any organisation or working, where the working practices are not what they would expect.
Do you expect over the next few years to remain sort of a figure in cycling, remain connected to cycling?
I hope so. It would seem a shame to kind of waste the opportunity to slightly improve things. And I'm in no way an activist. I'm not going to be out there with a banner or shouting, no, I want change and I want it yesterday. I think the way to deal with it is to have common sense and explain it in terms where I don't necessarily say it in a kind of council speak where it's all projections and going forward and all that kind of using that language. I think it's for my generation who are usually the people in charge, if you speak to them in a language they understand and you kind of nudge them in the direction of where they want to go, then that's how change will happen. If you start demanding things, then that gets people's backs up and they kind of say, well, wait a minute, and there's a resistance. So I think it'll be a slow change, but it'll gradually happen.
So what will you be doing on Christmas Day? A sneaky early ride, a quick half hour on the turbo before the turkey? Nico Roche won't be missing the chance to get out on the road.
Christmas Day, first thing I'll do is go for a little bike ride and then have lunch with my mother and my two brothers in Monaco.
Is there a bit of Irish input, a bit of French, a bit of anything else?
It's a bit of both. I can't say I do not like my Irish pudding.
What's Irish pudding? Come on.
That's Irish pudding. You know, it's probably something similar to the British pudding, but we put a bit of Guinness in it, so it tastes as nice. And it's also pretty good because it helps it conserve it for a bit longer too. Yeah, glass of champagne. I'll probably have more champagne on the 24th. In the evening, because in France with my family we also celebrate the 24th in the evening, hence my bike ride on the 25th to kind of balance out both days, but probably a bit of wine during Christmas lunch. And you know what, when I was living in Italy they also celebrate Stephen's Day on the 26th, so you could go on for almost a week if you wanted to.
Nico Roche, and although Cadel Evans isn't competing anymore, he remembers his festive routine very well.
When I raced, the main thing was that I would go to Australia for the off-season, being the only time that I could see my family, but also because of the summer there in Australia. And I made a habit of going for a ride on Christmas Day, not for the training reason, but because you eat so much food on Christmas Day, if you skip lunch and go for a ride, you actually get to dinner really hungry and can enjoy all the good food. And so I would often go for I have Christmas with my close family in the morning, go for a ride during the day, no traffic on the road, of course, on Christmas Day, normally blaring summer heat, come home, have dinner with my family and the extended family, and that was for me a great Christmas Day.
Christmas Day at the Wyman House doesn't sound very festive at all. All part of the hard reality of being a pro cross rider.
So we drive to Zolder and we wake up in the morning, we'll open some presents, and then we'll get in the car, we'll drive to Zolder, we'll do the course, and then we go to our little accommodation. We've got a little house just on the back side of the venue, and then Steph will go to the manager's meeting, and then we'll probably have some pasta-based dish for dinner and then go to bed. We'll probably get doping control because they normally come to me as older.
It's all glamorous, the life of a cyclocross pro, isn't it?
Yeah. Last year we had Christmas for the first time in, 10 years. It was really cool. And this year, back to the grind.
And that's pretty much it from this edition, apart from the podcast quiz. Last time we asked you which team Brian Holm was riding for in 1991, when he won Paris-Brussels and Paris-Camembert. The answer was Histor Sigma, and Peter Target wins the Ruler T-shirt. This time the prize is a pair of wonderful socks, from the Wonderful Socks. If you can answer this, Pippa York first won the British National Road Race Championship as an amateur in 1978. When did she last win? When did Pippa York, riding as Robert Miller, last win the British National Road Race Championship? Go to the podcast section of the Ruler website. Full details on how to enter are there. Have a peaceful Christmas. The podcast will be back in 2018.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.